Well, good morning, folks, to the first parallel session. So we are in session 1A, Physical Sciences, Modern Physics, and the Nature of Reality. And we have three speakers in this session. And my name is Arnold Sikkim. I'm the moderator of this session. I'm a physics professor at Trinity Western University. So our first speaker is Bob Kaita, who is the emeritus physics professor at Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory, where he's conducted nuclear fusion energy research for nearly four decades. He's a fellow of the American Scientific Affiliation and a member of the editorial board of the journal Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith. And in fact, in this session, we have all of the speakers are fellows of the American Scientific Affiliation. In the program, you can see a little asterisk beside someone's name that indicates that they're a fellow. So you don't have to be a fellow to speak, but we have three fellows in our presentation this morning. So let's welcome Bob.
Thanks very much. I'm a little bit vertically challenged compared to Arnold, but I appreciate his introduction and the opportunity to speak to you. So today I'll be speaking about modern physics and faith in things unseen. And by introduction, I'd like to point out that quantum mechanics and general relativity are often cited as the greatest achievements in modern physics. And they underlie a commonly used devices like global positioning systems and lasers, but are generally hidden from public view. Only recent developments like quantum computing raise the public awareness of the odd features of quantum mechanics, and I'm going to give you a very brief introduction to what they might be. Now, to begin with, we'll try to talk about some of the fundamental problems that we found in classical mechanics and the drawing it to then the situation in terms of explaining some of the odd features of quantum mechanics at the beginning of the 20th century. And so this is something that is still widely used as a depiction of what people think of in terms of atoms, that you have an electron orbiting around a proton. The electron, however, orbiting the nucleus should give off energy. Otherwise, radio transmission wouldn't work. And so electrons in this kind of model would then spiral into the nucleus. So instead, you make one of these really crazy assumptions where, and by the way, I should tell people in the audience that L equals 2 pi r is the only math you're going to see in this physics talk, where for purposes of illustration, I'm taking the electron orbit and then turning it into a straight line. And so this is an approach developed by the German physicist Erwin Schrödinger in 1926 by starting of this picture of thinking of electrons as, instead of particles, waves instead for this purpose. And then so you have a situation, and this is where it gets really weird, the wavelengths and amplitudes correspond to probabilities. And so one way to look at this new view of the electron is that if you have this strange thing called a probability wave, if it's too big, it doesn't fit on the line that corresponds to that orbit. Too small, it doesn't fit on the line even. But in the Goldilocks sense, if it's just right, it fits on that line. So that then, translating it into the model that we have for the atom, if it's too big, the probability is, in the simplified model, zero. If it's too small, it's zero. But the probability of finding an electron right there is one. It's just light, in this kind of oversimplification. So now what happens is that given that strange view of reality based on probabilities, let's look at quantum mechanics and reality. Now quantum mechanics and this what I call new reality is based on the fact that quantum mechanics allows you to calculate these kinds of probability amplitudes, but are not measurable in themselves. They help to calculate things about atoms, but you can't measure them. However, what they do is that they give you the probability, just to repeat, the measurable locations of electrons and other subatomic particles. So then probabilities can thus represent the way science allows non-measurable reality because they lead to measurable reality. This is my take on this. Now you go ahead and let's talk about another thing that's related to probability. Radioactivity. It has no classical analog. Now, the atomic nuclei with different numbers of protons and neutrons are considered unstable. And so they can decay by emitting a whole class of particles. or radiation to leave more stable nuclei. And a bit of history note, before people really understood what was going on, this kind of is, by the Greek alphabet, sort of the way they were discovered. Alpha particles coming out, beta, and then later on we found out what they were, and then gamma. So radioactivity is not classical, because decay creates new elements, and only the probability of decay of a collection of radioactive nuclei can be known. There's no classical analog to this. Now, here we go into a very famous example, for those of you who studied quantum mechanics, the story of poor Schrodinger's cat. And as a parenthetical note, apparently Erwin Schrodinger really had a cat. So we're not going to go into all the moral consequences of playing around with real cats. But the idea is that you put in this rather terrible experiment the cat, the radioisotope, a detector and a hammer, and a container of poison gas. Now, this is a system that you could, not that I'd advise you to do this actually, but you could actually create this out of real objects, you know. Now, the real state of the cat is determined when the box is opened. The cat is alive, all these things you put in the box. But the question is whether the cat is still real when the state of the cat is not known to prior opening the box. Just to repeat, real objects you put in the box. Then you open the box and you find out whether the cat is dead or alive, whether the probability of decay occurred, and the poison is released. Given that, this illustrates, at least for me in quantum mechanics, the limits of scientific knowledge in the classical sense. The initial state, just to repeat, Schrodinger's cat outside the box is a state that is observable and known. And from that point of view, it is scientifically real. We have an intermediate state, Schrodinger's cat inside the box. The state is unobservable and unknown in the classical sense. It is still, however, I posit, rational to believe in the reality of the unseen cat, even though you don't know its state. Then finally, you have the final state. Schrodinger's cat is back outside the box. The state is observable and again known. So in that sense, no question about it, that is scientifically real. Now, okay, disclaimer, I'm not going to describe in detail what quantum computing is, but just to give you a flavor of some of the weirdness that goes on involved in something called quantum computing. Now, in classical computing, you only allowed fully known operation to a final state that either keeps the initial state, living cat, and actually some people call these cat states, living cat, equals one, or changes the initial state to a deceased cat. The cat is zero. No box can classically exist where the state of the cat is unknown. It's fully determined. Now, this is where, in very crude analog to quantum computing, what then quantum mechanics allows you and introduces. It allows the unknown operation to a final state that is known only after the box is opened and the final state is measured. So what does that mean? States corresponding to a living cat, one, and deceased cat, zero, are entangled. And this is a very general definition of what is meant by entanglement that is not a classical concept. So then quantum computing, in a very general sense, is more powerful, in quotes, than classical computing because entanglement allows more possible outcomes for machines with the same number of bits. Instead of just zero and one, you have more possibilities. I mean, that's the flavor of what I would consider quantum computing to be. Now then, we go along to what I would call the re-envisioning of the rationality of faith. Now, here I talk about something that's very familiar to most, if not all of you, the example of faith of the ancients. Now, the 13th chapter of the letter to the Hebrews in the New Testament begins as follows. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. You hold that thought. And subsequent illustrations all contain what then people in physics called observables. the creation of the universe, and the faith-based asks of Noah, Abraham, and Moses. Now let's take an example. From the framework of modern science, you say that the initial state, Abraham is an initial state. He lives in Mesopotamia. The state is observable and known. And so there's no question about it that it is scientifically real. Then here's the interesting part. There's an intermediate state, Abraham called to go. The state is determined by an unobservable and scientifically unknowable God, whose reality can still be rationally believed in, all right? Then you get to the final state, using again the framework for modern physics, you have the final state, Abraham lives in Canaan. The state is observable again and known, and no doubt about it, scientifically real. So then what happens is that, and again my opinion, you have a potential conceptual similarity between the invisible probability amplitudes and faith of ancients in unseen leading to the seen. Now, here again is something else that's unique, if you will, or new to quantum mechanics, which you don't find in classical mechanics, is the necessity of interpretation in quantum mechanics. What does it all mean? Time doesn't allow me to go into different interpretations of quantum mechanics. There's a whole rich literature in this. But for the first time, you have introduced into the fabric of science in general, and physical science in particular, the idea that then, because of the idea of interpretation being introduced into science, it allows faith in God in itself to be among possible rational explanations for observable and real actions of people. So what is the point of this? The implications for me, for science and religion, is that the truths of religion that acknowledge observable historical personages and events can still be challenged by examining the accuracy of their accounts. You could go look for evidence of all these people, where they lived, and this is what keeps archaeologists and historians in business. However, you can't be so dismissive about what I just described by saying that the rationality of believing in such religions are questionable, but they can no longer be questioned with the claim that only reality explainable by science can exist. You can't make that claim anymore within the, if you want to be consistent with the conceptual framework, in my opinion, of modern physics. So that is then the conclusion I'd like to draw. Again, not any proof in any way by existence of God, but then, shall we say, a rethinking away from this idea of a very doctrinaire sort of materialism that then puts limits on rationality, claiming science as the justification. So those are my thoughts. Thank you very much.
Hello. Hi, Dr. Kaida. I'm just wondering a very nerdy question. With regards to the field of quantum mechanics, what is your interpretation of like, do you go with the Copenhagen school, or do you go with, do you believe in the multiverse? Or like, do you think the world only comes into existence with consciousness?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. You know, just to repeat, what interpretation do I believe in?
Yeah.
You know, just to reiterate the point, if I may, you know, what I'm saying is that this is something entirely new to physics, because before we didn't have any room for interpretation.
Right.
And so that's why I think that for me personally, I think that I prefer the Copenhagen interpretation. We just don't know about its reality until we go ahead and do the measurement, because I think that that is the simplest thing to hold on to. I think that one of the reasons why, I admit I have a bias against this whole idea of multiverses and many worlds and the direction that goes into it, is that, well, as one philosopher of science puts it, does that mean that then, let's say, if you have a detector that then detects something, depending on the measurement that the detector makes, the detector itself creates a universe? You know, that is a certain conceptual difficulty that I have with this multiverse. So I prefer the what I, in my opinion, call consider the more conservative view of the Copenhagen interpretation.
Okay, thank you.
Bob, thank you. That was great. And it refers, it clearly to me, refers back to David Hume's arguments about science as being a way of ruling out contingent things. And so I appreciate that. I wonder if that, if the same kind of effect is due to, comes out of Gödel's theorem in mathematics that can, that shows the limitations of mathematics as well as science.
Yeah. Okay, so the question is about Gödel's theorem. So I think that then there, I think, at least in my opinion, it's a little bit different in that the essence of this Gödel's theorem is that, you know, with any system of a finite number of axioms, you know, there are propositions that are properly formulated, but can be neither determined to be within that system of axioms true or false. So I think I subscribe to that. But it may be a little bit different here in the sense that what we're talking about is a different kind of indeterminacy, if you will. There's a logical indeterminacy embedded in Gödel's theorem, but then the kind of intrinsic indeterminacy that I'm talking about in the physical universe. So that would be my answer to that.
It's always bothered me, this thing about Schrodinger's cat. And so if the cat is in a mixed state, it seems to imply that I'm also in a mixed state. And if you have difficulty understanding that the instrument creates the reality, I also wonder how we create reality. So do you have any comment on that?
Oh, boy. I'm tempted to make a comment like, no question about being in a mixed up state, at least for me, because that's what my wife tells me very often. But I think, though, that in that sense, it does point out something, you know, rather profound about the fact that you can formulate such an experiment to begin with that has no classical analog. Now, and this goes back to the first question about, you know, how do you then interpret what's going on? And what's very disconcerting is that you can set up this macabre experiment. You can do that at all. And that you can't, in the classical sense, trace it through. That there's no such thing as a mixed state. And so I think that then, as far as how to translate that into our own reality, what you can do is that I would say that it's hard because in a way, how can we tell, or who is the observer?
Right.
The reason why the Schrodinger's cat example is so intriguing is because it's sort of the perspective of the observer, the person who creates the state, and then creates something that's intrinsically indeterminate, and then looks at their net result. How's that that translates into us individually? I don't know. But I'm saying that, at least in my estimation, that analogy is useful for the purpose I just described and kind of limited, if you will, to then go beyond that. That's the best I could answer.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah.
Your talk made me think about the two terms we often use in science-faith dialogue, methodological naturalism and metaphysical naturalism. And I wondered, particularly for the methodological naturalism, if you felt like there are any implications of your thinking here for that idea of methodological naturalism and how we conduct science as Christians.
Yeah, in fact, that's one of the questions I was thinking about the problem of metaphysical and methodological naturalism. What happens is that, as you're aware, a lot of people just go ahead and conflate the two. And so that then saying that, to simplify, there is only a metaphysical and methodological naturalism, because in my interpretation, metaphysical naturalism follows from methodological naturalism. I mean, there's nothing else. But then here, what I tried to point out is that you can't blithely make that jump because what happens is that then it neglects what the assumptions you're making and some underlying concepts that you might have been able to get away with back in the day in the classical realm. But now with quantum mechanics, what happens is that you can't go ahead and make the statement that, because, going back to previous questions, everything is so well determined that then there's no choice but to then be a metaphysical naturalist, if I could use that term. But now we're in the situation where intrinsic to the limitations of our knowledge and intrinsic to the way the universe is, you can't immediately make that connection that if you're a methodological naturalist, you must be a metaphysical naturalist, and that's the only thing that's rational.
Thank you.
I have 1,000 questions, but
okay,
I'll just ask you if you have thought anything about a comparison with mathematics other than the Gödel proof, which was just talked about. That Pythagorean, you go back to the rational numbers, that they were the only thing, and then the continuum, and this being somewhat resolved in Cantor's work with infinity and that sort of thing. Do you see an analogy between the mathematical world and the quantum physics world occurring at about the same time?
Yeah, that's an interesting question about the relationship with mathematics. I think that one of the things that I found very interesting about all of this is that everything that I described, you know, all the things that people talk about in terms of quantum mechanics, all the underlying mathematics itself, I feel, is very well determined. You know, and so from that point of view, it's not the mathematics is, if you will, the language or the tool that allows us to be, if you will, quantitative and describe what's going on. So that's why I would make the distinction between mathematics as providing the framework, the capability for looking at this and being quantitative, even to the level of my simple drawings in terms of wavelengths and probabilities and how they fit. These are all in the classical sense, not in the classical sense, but all computable. They're all determinable from that point of view. And so the mathematics is the tool by which then we can base these are rather, if you will, counterintuitive and non-classical conclusions. That would be my conclusion. Yeah.
I missed the few minutes at the beginning of your talk, but I wondered if there was anything in quantum mechanics or in your focus here that pertained to Christianity, because it seems, at least here, you're talking about religions in general.
Yeah. Well, I think that then your point is certainly well taken, and I was kind of admittedly restricted in my scope in what I was going to then cover, you know, in my talk. I would then say, in a broad sense, beyond the scope of this talk, what I would say is that this connection to Christianity is the connection I have as a scientist in general to Christianity, that because of adding this to all that we can comprehend about the universe, and its structure, its mathematical structure, I can't explain why it's there, that, as Einstein said, it's comprehensible, except for a very critical point, which is, if we didn't have this ability to do science, the resurrection of Jesus Christ would not be so singular. What allows us to then say, this is really exceptional, because it's all based on what we would call in our parlance, foundational. All this science and mathematics that we have, to then tell us what is, in quotes, normal and what is ordinary. And for me as a Christian, the fact that then we have this basis allows us to determine what is extraordinary, which is the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
You analyze this with the observer outside the box. What if the observer gets in the box with the cat? Does your analysis change?
Oh boy, that's the first time I've gotten that question. And it goes off to the previous question about, you know, just the idea of the observable, or you being in the mixed up state, which I often am. I think that then that, let me just leave it to then say that that's beyond the scope of this particular model. And we'll have a discussion over break on that. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Bob.